When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan, and the author of Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls. If you'd like a signed copy, you can order one from the Margate Bookshop. They deliver nationwide. Also, Your Book listeners can now pre-order my new novel, Careering, coming from Sphere next March. It's a workplace rom-com where the love interest is the job itself. Can rookie intern Imogen and workaholic maverick editor Harry make peace with the fact that they love their jobs, but their jobs won't ever love them back? Or is a chaotic rebellion calling? There's only one way to find out. Pre-orders are available from Waterstones. Now on to today's guest, author and journalist Lucy Mangan. I've been a fan of Lucy's work for a very long time, especially her memoir, Bookworm, A Personal History of Children's Literature. Listeners, that one is right up your alley. We're talking today to celebrate the publication of Lucy's first novel, Are We Having Fun Yet? An exhilarating, exhaustive, funny and infuriating diary of one woman's life with her young family. Lucy is very much a reader's writer, if you know, you know. We talked about our mutual love of Eve Garnett, the Phantom Tollbooth, the perfection of Persephone books and why we need to see ourselves in the stories we read. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I have been desperate to invite you on for ages. And I love the book so much. I love Are We Having Fun Yet? And it's just so funny and exhilarating. And it's making me feel really, really cross, but sort of deliciously cross in the way that fiction can.
I hope so. Yeah, people keep saying to me there's such a lot of rage in it. And I thought, God, I thought I'd really held myself back. I thought I did really well to get the balance right.
Well, I don't know if it's because I listened to you on the Mid-Alt podcast and I love them and I love their podcast. So yeah, I think the anger there was, I think they were very keen to get the rage out or to start the rage. But also I know on that podcast you said that of late you've not been reading in the way that you usually read.
I mean, the pandemic has been such a weird time. And over lockdown, I went in and out. You know, sometimes I was just reading like my life depended on it. And other days I'd just be staring at the wall and going, imagine reading, imagine, what a joke. And there was one very weird period that actually was quite frightening and upsetting where I couldn't read, didn't want to read, and couldn't imagine ever being a reader again. I didn't feel like a reader anymore. It was like a thing I once did and now was over for me. And that was really, really weird, because there've been times when I, you know, haven't been able to get into books, and there's been times when I haven't really been in the mood very much, but I've never not felt like a reader. And I did towards the end of lockdown. I was like, everything, just something had been lost in me, kind of cauterized. It was very, very odd.
Must have been so frightening, because I also loved your memoir, Bookworm. And I know that, you know, you have been reading in a passionate and very immersive way for as long as you've been conscious.
Yeah, exactly. It's not till it goes that you realise what an important part, or what a large part of your identity it is. It's like when you lose a job for the first time and you kind of go, oh God, my work is part of me. I didn't realise, because I've always been at work. But reading, I mean, whoever thinks that's going to go?
So what was the book that brought it back?
There wasn't really. I mean, I'd love that to be the kind of Damascene moment or the cure, but it really wasn't. It was just a gradual recovery once we came out of lockdown. It feels like it's been a really long time since I read properly, immersively, like I used to. And I don't know if that's now something that I've got to get used to, a bit like I got used to reading as an adult rather than as a child. Because when you're a child, you know, you really are, you're that porous and everything, that you really do connect with the book, and it's just another reality for you. And then when you grow up, you read in a different way. You start to appreciate what the writer's doing, and you enjoy the story, and you didn't enjoy this bit, and you become that bit more detached. Mm. And occasionally you get the book that blows it all away. I remember reading Gone with the Wind once in my mid to late 20s, and literally stayed in bed over the weekend to read it, and that was like reading like a child again. And the same again years later in my late 30s, reading Patrick Ness's The Knife of Never Letting Go. Again, it's just such a cracking story, as well as being clever and moving and all the rest of it.
I don't know the Patrick Ness at all.
It's his YA trilogy. The trilogy overall is called Chaos Walking. And Knife of Never Letting Go is the first one. And it's about, it's a planet that has only males on it, only men and boys. And they can all hear each other's thoughts all the time. So the planet is just filled with noise, and quite horrible noise at that, most of the time. And there's no privacy in it, and no quietness, no stillness. And Patrick Ness said this, it was based around the experience of teenagers now in the social media world, that they are never alone. They are never truly have any experience of solitude or privacy or sitting in the moment. Until one day this boy on the planet hears a patch of silence, although he can hardly give it a name. He hears this patch of, and it turns out a girl has arrived on the planet, and he can't read her thoughts. So obviously then we get into the whole other range of metaphors, that they can't quite understand each other, but in that difference and in that distance, they actually discover something else of value. Anyway, it was just one, and a bit of cracking story as well. You know, as you'll often get in books for younger readers and books for young adults, plot has far more primacy than in a lot of literature for adults, proper books. And it was just great. Yes, again, just stayed up till 4 o'clock in the morning reading that when I really shouldn't have, and did have to go to work that day because I was an adult.
I was just thinking when you were telling me about The Knife of Never Letting Go, about the people I've talked to who have really struggled to read and connect with books in the pandemic, and they found periods of escape, but also they can't, you know, it's that need to immerse yourself, even if, as you say, you do it in a different way when you're an adult than you do as a child. And whether it's to do with the fact that we've sort of had that really strange period where we were sort of properly alone, but never alone, you know, in that social media way. And if it was a fear of kind of having so little actual contact and only the weird sort of very like flattened but heightened online contact, because I think I had moments of feeling this where if I let go of that link and went away with a book and sort of let myself be in a book, then everything would be severed and I'd have nothing and no roots.
Oh, that's interesting. No, I didn't feel like, because I didn't do hardly any Zoom calls or quizzes or anything, or any WhatsApp stuff. I continued living my life much as it was led before, which is without much human contact. I go out about and see friends about once a month. So it was all very much my direction of travel. I think it was more the uncertainty and the anxiety and the fear that eats up your mental bandwidth and makes it very, very hard to read. And it's almost, it sounds trite, do I sound like an absolute fart ass? But it's like being, you know, if you have lots of problems in your life, if you're poor, if you have lots of things eating up your mental bandwidth of just surviving, you're not going to be a great reader because you literally don't have the time and resources and the social capital and every other kind of capital to sit down and enjoy yourself in that way. It made me appreciate, and this is partly, of course, why children generally can read better and more deeply than adults, is because they don't have responsibilities and things intruding on them all the time. When they sit down with a book, they sit down with a book. Whereas even now, at the best of times, an adult will sit down with a book and, you know, have to think, well, after this, I'll do my taxes, my this, that, and the other, call the optician, blah, 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 blah. And then in the pandemic, you're just scoured out even more by the raging uncertainty of what was all going on at the time.
Going back to when reading was, you know, easy, natural and fun, when you started writing Bookworm, I was wondering whether, when the book was kind of emerging, even before the writing started, if there was one particular book where you thought, I must put this book in my book. This is the book that I need to tell other readers about, and this is the book that I need to remember.
There were two or three, really, and then there was just a cascade. I've got to put this one in, But it was Tom's Midnight Garden, which was and remains probably the most perfect, closest to perfection you'll ever get for a children's book, especially, which is a time slip book with Tom. Goes to stay with his aunt to recover or to get away from measles. And it's in a converted Victorian mansion house. And of course, when this clock strikes midnight, it slips back to how it was. The old house is complete and the garden is back. And Hetty, who lives in the garden, is back. Hattie, sorry. And it's just the most beautiful. And it's modulated so carefully. And you barely notice the slip and you accept it all. Entirely, and the world is perfect, and the relationship between the girl and the boy across time and space is just exquisite, and the whole thing was just so lovely. I thought, if anyone, and it's more or less a classic, so I mean lots of people do know about it, but that was the one I really wanted to write about. And then there was The Phantom Tollbooth, which was the first book I ever read that was about words and about really about writing in a way, and made me conscious that what I loved about words was that you could play with them as things as well as make them read them as a story. They were sort of fun in themselves, my version of Lego, really. But Phantom Tollbooth is about the Dictionopolis and Digitopolis, and Milo, this bored, disaffected, awful child, goes to visit them in his little toy car that mysteriously gets sent to him through a phantom and has to pass through a phantom toll booth. And again, you just accept this, you see, because it's so brilliantly written out. Off he goes. He goes through the doldrums, which are obviously quite a depressing place, and meets Humbug and Tok the watchdog and all this kind of clever stuff. Meets all these characters. And it's kind of heightened Lewis Carroll in a way by Norton Juster. And I just loved it as a completely different plane of understanding. And that was, so they were sort of my twin poles of childhood reading. And then the third one was the first funny book I ever read, which was Private Keep Out by Gwen Grant. And that was, apart from being very funny, it's this nameless heroine who lives in a Nottinghamshire colliery town just after the war. And it was the first time I'd really seen my own family's sensibility reflect, not that I knew the word then, but reflected back at me, because they were this northern family that just communicated through sarcasm instead of feelings or anything like that. And I suddenly went, oh, yes, this is us. Oh, God, I've not seen that before. Despite having loved and enjoyed so many other books, but they were mostly canonical, mostly, you know, your middle class, Noel Stretfield, all that kind of thing. Lots of school stories, and obviously had lots of connections with them, but it wasn't until they got this very specific family in Private Keep Out that I went, oh, that's something else. That is really, that's us, that's me. And it made me think, it makes me think now how important representation is for much more important identities than being. No.
There is something really exhilarating, isn't there, of sort of feeling allowed, and especially if books have been magical and wonderful, but not missed the mark exactly, but you felt as though you're the one who's got to do the work to live in the world. Yeah. And when a book is just welcoming you, I think it's not just that book, it's you feel more a part of all of the books and of the other books that you then go on to read.
Yeah, it's lovely, and it's and it makes you realise where they fall short, that sometimes it's not you that's not getting the book, or it's not, you know, not understanding this, that and the other. It's because you're being asked, you know, the author has made too many assumptions, you're being asked to make too many leaps. And it makes you think, even because we do it from really the moment we can read, as girls and women, you're often being asked to put yourself at the male point of view without anyone knowing that they're writing that or acknowledging that they're requiring half the population to do that. And that's a huge thing. So you're already quite often making that leap and not being yourself or not finding yourself without even realising it.
I often think of E. Nesbitt and the Samiad books, and is it Oswald, and that he's written in a way that's sort of very engaging, and you don't, he sort of presents himself as a third person character while writing in the first person. And that being the only hero of a book that I really connected with, and it's probably as simple and basic, and I'm as, you know, easily fooled and led as like, oh, we just said I. So, you know, that first person identification, but whether it is E. Nesbitt's ability to write a boy hero to make boys pick up the book, but someone that she could make sure that girls could connect with and not feel any distance or remove from.
Yeah, I don't know. I was never a great fan of The Treasure Seeker, so I don't know. I'd have to go back and read it. That would be really interesting. I think she was one of the first to write a children's, I could be wrong here, she was one of the first to write a children's book from the first person anyway, let alone to do something so clever as to have this kind of unreliable narrator.
A book that I was really excited to read about in Bookworm. Sorry to go on about your book that came out a couple of years ago and you've got a fabulous brand new book. But just because my family read it and loved it and all the books in the series, and I'd not heard anyone else mention these books ever, The Family from One End Street and the Associated Stories. And I think a lot about them going off to the Dewdrop Inn, and gosh, I can't remember her name, but she's allowed to make custard because there's an abundance of eggs and no one minds if she makes a mistake and the eggs run out.
Can you imagine in post-war England what that was like? No, I mean, The Family from One End Street is a lovely, I mean, people are aware, I think, of often the first one, but they're very, very rarely aware that there's a sequel, and more rarely aware that there's a third one, which is the best one, which is Holiday at the Dewdrop Inn, where Kate gets to live my life, my dreams. I really did think this book was written especially for me, but she goes off, this town child goes off to stay at the Dewdrop Inn, which is a thatched cottage and pub, for the whole summer, and gets to do the whole, you know, the county fair, the wildflower gathering, everything, and you basically just live in a village in the 19, I can't remember where it's set, because the first one was quite early. I want to say she wrote that in the 30s, but I could be wrong. But yeah, but then, you know, this old-fashioned, you know, and I just couldn't get enough. I read it on a Cornish holiday and thought, it just book, I could stop reading now. Books don't get any better than this, clearly. As she walks along the cow parsley hedges, and I could see cow parsley from where I was. I couldn't believe it.
I love the idea that you were on holiday already, but fantasising about, you know, being in a different village at a different time.
Well, you know, it was still 1980, whatever, and the present. Who wants to live in the present? God. Not me at the age of 10.
Well, me at the age of 36, if I'm entirely honest.
Oh, God. You should see me. Yes, you should see me at 47, Christ.
I know there was lots of kind of 18 months ago, everybody went off and read The Plague and things. But were there, in times when we need joy in literature, or wherever we can get it, what are the books that bring you joy? And are there books that you reread often in desperate times or times of necessity?
I think I was a fool for much of the pandemic, because I have a sort of rule now, which again is stupid of anyway. I have a sort of rule at the moment as I get older, which is not to reread while I've still got new stuff to read. Now, of course, I have more new books now, literally, or books, unread books, I should say, to see me out. However long I live, I cannot read the books I currently have. So I'm on a hiding to nothing with finishing them anyway. But what I'm doing in the meantime is denying myself the deep, deep pleasures of rereading and comfort reading. So I must stop that. And I hereby pledge to stop that. And especially so during the blinking pandemic, because looking back, what I really should have done and wanted to do was reread Maeve Binchy, Light a Penny Candle and Circle of Friends before she started writing about modern Ireland. You know, that doesn't, I like the past stuff again. And I should have reread all my lovely Nora Lofts and just given myself a break, because there's so much value to rereading. That's when you get, you know, that's when you learn how to read. That's when you learn how to write, certainly when you reread. Stop, I put this stupid rule in place that I'm now quite cross about.
Oh, but I absolutely feel that way. And I think, you know, I'm very, 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 very new to writing fiction. But, you know, if I can do it, it's because I have read, you know, Marion Keyes accidentally, almost in a sort of an academic way. And I've read so many of those books, you know, 3, 4, 5 times, more than that. And just to get a sense of how she's doing it. And there's not a sort of like, oh, I must really sit down and frown at this and work it out and unravel it. But
yeah,
it's impossible to miss it the more you sort of go through it and study it. And the it's the rhythm of the sentences that I love, but also the way certain things fall. And again, it's that, you know, the brilliance of the sort of the unreliable narrators who don't know how unreliable they are either, and the way that you're sort of you're brought along with them. But I wanted to ask you about Nora Loft, who I don't know at all.
Well, she's wonderful. She's a, or was, a historical novelist, and she writes, I suppose sagas is the word, but she'll follow, for example, she'll follow in her most famous trilogy called The Old House, or The Old House at Vine. She follows, for example, one house through the ages and all the different families or generations of family that live in one place or one village. And her historical knowledge and the minutiae of life and the texture of it all is just amazing. You know, there are lots of writers who could do the big stuff and do all the kings and queens stuff and set it all in court and are really good at all that. And I love those too. But I'd much rather read about the absolutely granular life of a medieval peasant on the site of a particular house that then grows through the ages. And she's so good. She tells such a good story. And that's, she can rock a story like no one else, while also building in all this material in such an organic way that you just feel like you're there, while also just compelled to find out what happens to all these characters. And I just think she's one of those novelists you're kind of glad, a bit like Kathleen Windsor and Anya Seton. You're very glad that they were almost forced by their times not to become academic historians and instead had to turn to novel writing for ladies, because no one else could have done it with such all-round satisfaction.
So I do love a book where there's that sense of what a person's priorities are. And I do struggle with historical fiction because I think a lot of it is when a person has done so much research and they don't want to kind of throw any of it away. And there's this sort of the element of, you know, well, I know how the architect built the house they're living in, and I'm going to talk great detail about the building materials or the plumbing, or I don't know. But to know what it is to live through that emotionally, and, you know, what your sort of a person's concerns will be. I think that's what I love about a lot of like children's literature and young adult literature. And they're not worried about, you know, mortgages and bills and, you know, is the roof going to fall in? But they are as worried about different things, and writers who capture that and take that seriously. And I think that's my pandemic reading after years of being told to read the Cazalet books by Elizabeth Jane Howard. I did. And I just think she writes the children so, so brilliantly well, because there is that sense of, they have so many anxieties and fears and concerns. And of course they do, because they're all sort of like, you know, don't worry about it, but war is about to break out. But that sense of how you'd apply your sort of an intelligent but childish mind to processing all of that.
I mean, I suppose that's what we're always looking for, isn't it? In any book, you're looking for a writer who's totally in command of their material, but is also confident enough and secure enough in themselves to then get out of the way and tell the story and just use what they know to inform it, rather than, as you say, just give you basically an extended Wikipedia entry with a bit of plot thrown in. And I think that's what Nora Loft and Annie Seton and people like that do so, so well. And of course it's necessary for children's books, because God, will children chuck a book aside if they feel they're being overtly or covertly educated instead of being entertained?
So I'm looking at the books behind you. I can't quite make out any titles. I'm curious about those Persephones.
Yeah, I'll move a bit closer. These are unread Persephones, because my read Persephones are all, I keep most of my read books behind my unread books to keep me honest and keep me going.
No rereading.
No rereading, exactly. God, I'm an idiot. But this is Can you still hear me if I turn away?
I think so. Let's have a go.
Okay. So I've got Despised and Rejected by Rose Allertine and Heat Lightning by Helen Hull. And I can't remember what either of those is about because I think I think they were very kindly sent to me by Nicola Bowman at Persephone when I did. I wrote the foreword for a Dorothy Whipple called Young Anne, which is the first one she wrote. Not, I think the first one published as well, but Persephone published it later. She sent me those as a thank you.
I mean, Despised and Rejected, I don't know either of those books. That's the most brilliant
good,
title.
Let's have a look. Your ears are pricked up. Let's see. But as with everything, it doesn't matter for Persephone, and that's why they can afford not to put blurs, because you just know you're going to love it.
For shame, I have not read any Dorothy Whipple.
You fool.
I know. I'm going to remedy this immediately. But tell me, what was the one that you wrote the foreword for?
Young Anne, which is her first. So I wouldn't actually start there because it's not her best. It's lovely. It's great, you know, and Dorothy Whipple's worst day is better than most people's best day. So, that, you know, do read it. But her others are her sort of her major works are sort of things like They Knew Mr. Knight, which is just this devastating portrait of a family being infiltrated by this sort of a con man, but not just a nasty, just one of those people that gets in your life and is just toxic and poisonous and takes and holds the family beneath the waterline, really. It's just awful, and it's brilliant. There's another one who's, I'm terrible with titles, so forgive me, but there's one about, is it Someone at a Distance? That's just the most, again, incredible detailed portrait of, amongst other things, domestic violence. And it's a bit like Tenant of Wildfell Hall. Nothing, you know, most of it happens off screen, as it were, but you feel the fear and that very particular fear and tension and malign influence of someone who's got control of a household.
I am intrigued. I went in on this.
Do be.
The vibe I'm getting, correct me if I'm wrong, is sort of like if Anita Bruckner were to write psychological thrillers.
I don't know. I've never read any Anita Bruckner, and I don't even know enough about her to know her vibe, so I can't tell
a lot of people, I think, take again Anita Bruckner for Goodreads, because she's been sort of, I think, marketed as being quite a friend of the podcast, and me, Andy Miller, is on a one-man Bruckner crusade, but she's so funny. And I suppose I was thinking about, because that's what I always get the titles confused, but it might be A Friend from Abroad, or it might be A Start in Life, where part of the story is this woman sort of talking about her terrible, very sort of narcissistic, self-obsessed parents who, you know, kind of torment her and make unreasonable demands of her. And she is the sort of, you know, Brucknerish. I think she's almost had a life, but she is a spinster and a lady academic, and she's not quite ever managed to fully escape their clutches and get away. And then they do, but they've got a friend who's even worse, the parents have, and she's a sort of a Brighton hippie, but like a pre-hippie, and they sort of, there's just this week where they go away with her, and they just sort of have to eat this like terrible like carpet scrapings homemade muesli and go in the sea, and it just sounds like the most sort of bleak Spartan holiday ever. But she's got a real sort of like waspish, like extremely dry funny, but very very funny kind of cruel streak that I love. But she's got this really sort of emotional lucidity too.
I don't think Whipple's got a cruel streak. No, she's much more got a certain, she's got massive acuity, but there's no, it's just a wry commentary and delicate anatomization of situations, common situations and more extreme situations like violent husbands and things.
But I suppose, you know, it's a classic plot, isn't it? You know, a stranger comes to town. I think it's always interesting that, you know, sort of a person can infiltrate a situation.
And just the exploitation of innocence is always just horrible. You know, naivety is just, pushes my buttons, man.
A book that I read this summer, so not really a sort of lockdown book, but it's a book that I was sure, like, how have I not read this? This is something that, you know, when I was sort of 13 and intense, I was thinking of the Victoria Wood sketch where they're camping, and it's like, your mother said you were always intense when you were a child. Intense! I was always intense. Invitation to the Waltz. And that awkward cheat, and there's a bit where it's, have you read it?
No, again, I know Rosamund Leman, I haven't done anything. I've read so little of what I technically should have read, both in terms of should have read because they're good and everyone tells you to read, and should have read as in you would have thought I would, being like what I'm like and what else I've read. I don't know why I've got these massive gaping holes in my education.
No, well, this is my revenge because I'm very defensive about not having read any Dorothy Whipple. But there is this part where she's got a weird uncle and she comes downstairs and it's her birthday and she never quite knows how to kind of navigate his oddness and how to greet him. And it's like, I don't want to kiss him. Okay. Do I shake his hand? Yeah. I've got to do some sort of physical like greeting. And so she goes for a handshake and he slips, I think it's like 10 bobbin or something. And she immediately feels absolutely like a worm because she's, it looks like I was expecting him to give me money and I wasn't. And now I feel this like completely, I just want to hide under the table and I don't know what to do with myself. And it's a real, it's a very, very slight, and it's about sisters as well who are about, I think they're about a year apart and they start the book so close together, but just the event, this one party, and they're sort of very, they're posh but poor, and they've sort of been invited and included, but they're never quite really grand enough for most things, but they're a little bit too grand to kind of not feel awkward about things. But yes, I really loved that, and it just felt very emotionally granular and very nailing of the very specific awkwardness of being a specific sort of teenager.
Yeah, oh, the exquisite agonies of being a teenager. I wouldn't, as Victoria Wood says, I wouldn't go back again, I wouldn't be an adolescent again if you bumped my pocket money up to 3 and 6.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
We'll be back to Lucy soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week. I've chosen After the Storm by former podcast guest Emma Jane Unsworth. It could be described as dark, funny, unflinching and gorgeously written, a memoir about motherhood and postnatal depression. It could also be described as a book with a 21st century Emily Bronte vibe with a dash of Hunter S. Thompson. Lush, furious, hilarious, devastating and intense. After the Storm is published by Wellcome and out now. Now, back to Lucy.
I'm sad Victoria Wood never wrote a novel. And as those words leave my mouth, I think, did she?
Yes, I mean, I'm sad she didn't write just, you know, everything. I'm sad the whole world wasn't 100% Victoria Wood all the time. But, I mean, she had the freedom to do whatever she wanted to do. So hopefully she didn't want to write a novel. It was just, and maybe that means she couldn't or didn't think it would be something in her wheelhouse or not the best expression of her talents. Be interesting to know. But yes, I mean, Les Dawson wrote novels.
Oh, what were his novels like?
Yeah. I haven't read them. I gave a set to my dad a while back and I haven't nabbed them back yet. But again, comic novels, you know, one was called, I think, Whistle Down the Wind or some joke on wind anyway. But I think they were, you know, they did a bit of business and I'll be interested to read them when I finally am allowed back. He's shielding, so I only kind of nip back every now and again, try not to kill him with my any pre-COVID viral bits I'm shedding. Oh, what world.
Indeed.
World.
And I wonder whether it was a sort of, you know, lulls a popping thing, or whether he wanted to be, you know, a little bit more serious.
I think Les Dawson did have a bit of a hankering to be taken more seriously, or at least to be appreciated properly for what he was actually doing, because I think that's slightly different. I think he, like a lot of comedians, got a bit annoyed at people thinking it was easy just to come out and be funny if you were funny. But of course there was a lot more going on than that, and he liked to write. I mean, that was, it was tongue-in-cheek, all his stuff about, oh, the, you know, the, I remember sitting looking up at the sky, thinking, looking at the velvet, as if scattered, you know, as if a handful of diamonds had been scattered over a black velvet throne. I thought, I must put a roof on this ladder. So he liked to do all the riffing and a proper, you know, write, that is writing. It's not just one line of gags. But I suspect the novels are more of that kind of thing.
You know, to be very, very pretentious about it, I think, you know, great comedy is like poetry, and it is about rhythm and economy and really nailing feelings and ideas and that mix of what is familiar and what is surprising at the same time. I know you mentioned Private Keep Out, but I think it's a hell of a thing when we discover for the first time that novelists are allowed to be funny and it doesn't have to be a very serious business and there are funny books out there.
Woodhouse is always a discovery. I mean, the Just William books are kind of juvenile Woodhouse, and then when you do discover Woodhouse proper, they're just such a joy. Again, that's another one I should have reread in lockdown. What an idiot. Where it is just, you are reading just for the joy of the sentences and the joy of Jeeves and Wooster. What more can you say? Just these fleeting descriptions that conjure up in you know, a world entire, and plot works perfectly, and it takes just, you know, nothing lasts longer than it takes to read it.
I think a lot about how, more than any other sort of book I love, maybe even more than someone like, you know, Problematic Fabian Enlightenment, but those books are really, really quite similar, you know, structurally. You're not surprised, but you always are. Like, you know, I would never, ever, ever, ever hold it against him. Not that, you know, him as a state sort of should care, but to have, because producer Dale is a prolific reader and collector of P.G. Woodhouse, and there must be at least 100 or 200 of those books in this house, and you sort of always know what you're going to get, but it's nothing other than wonderful.
Woodhouse himself, you know, used to say he'd often get halfway through a book and realise he'd written it before, he'd used the plot before, and have to start again. But it's all in the execution.
And are you Jeeves and Wooster rather than Blandings, as a personal preference?
Yes, I've never really got into the others. Maybe Smith a bit, but yeah, no, Jeeves and Wooster I think are the best.
First one I've read, which has always been my favourite, I think, just because it was the first, and I had that giddy, I can't believe this is a book. And also it's sort of a book by like an old writer that, you know, this is, looks like I'm doing proper reading when I'm just cheating and having a lovely time. It's The Indiscretions of Archie. And even that his sort of the English aristocracy and their sort of bumbling nature versus these very sort of, you know, sharp-eyed, sharp-tongued Americans who didn't quite have a sense of irony and very sort of time's money about things. And Archie is the sort of the in-law just making everything worse and worse. I'm just very, very fond of that book and that world. And that's something that I'd like to reread. Also, I love The Clicking of Cuthbert and The Golf Ones. And I don't really know why, because, you know, to the point of, back to, you know, Enid Blyton skipping all of the lacrosse matches, but short stories about golf I really, really enjoyed. Well, I suppose they're not about golf, are they? Or they're only very superficially about golf.
Yeah, whereas Enid Blyton's very definitely just about lacrosse when she's writing about lacrosse.
Play up and play the game. No, thank you.
Absolutely. With all the broken fingers you can muster, yeah.
I was very much a Gwendolyn, Mary Lou hybrid.
God, yes, I could never quite reconcile the fact that we were supposed to love, you know, the heroines were these great hearty girls who loved sport. And I was like, yeah, but no.
Are there any books with your own children that you're sort of excited about sharing with them when they're ready? Or are there any books that you've kind of discovered with them that you didn't know about that you're delighted to find?
It's been a great disappointment to me that I've got one child, he's 10. And so far, the only book we've overlapped in liking at all, I love it, he likes it, is Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim. Because for everything else, he's very, likes fantasies, he likes big sweeping epics, whereas I was always very, you know, the furthest I ever got in fantasy is the Narnia books, obviously. Didn't do Tolkien, didn't do any of that. I like realism, naturalism. Whereas he's like, children, I can see children anytime I like. Give me swords, give me dragons, and all the rest of it. And now he's reading The Eagle of the Nine, which is Rosemary Sutcliffe, who I've never been able to get on with, despite everyone and unknowing. And clearly, I can see she's extraordinary talent and clever and brilliant writer, but just not for me. And he's off reading Eagle of the Ninth and talking to his grandfather about it and leaving me out at me, bookworm of bookworms, out in the cold. Nice. Don't have kids, people, that just disappoint you at every, the most unexpected turn.
That does seem to be the, well, no, well actually in Are We Having Fun Yet? I love those kids. And I just love, Evie is a sort of brilliantly malevolent presence. Do you have any favourite siblings in books or dream or nightmare brothers or sisters that you'd like or hate for your own?
I used to love, or still do love, the Marlowe family in the Antonia Forrest books, who's another underrated author who never quite got her due. She wrote, I think, 10 books about the Marlowe family. Four of them were school stories, and they were the ones that kind of got republished and were taken, so you've got these four books basically out of sequence with the remaining, and then the remaining six really never got republished until very recently by little independent imprints. But they were great. You know, there were sort of eight of them, I think, six girls, two boys. And again, she was just so good on family life and the bickering and the bantering and just having to learn to get on with these people that life has thrown you together with, and how you can still be different people and not particularly like, you might love each other but not particularly like each other. There's a great Nicola, is one of twins, and she doesn't particularly like her twin Laura. They're very, very different, and she doesn't much like her older sister Anne, who's very quiet and good and unimaginative, and Nicola just can't see why And it's brilliantly drawn how they're all part of a family. They love each other, but they don't necessarily have to like each other, which I think is a very subtle distinction to be drawing for, especially that quite a young age group. But I wanted to be, I'd quite like to be part of that clan.
And that's really interesting, I think, that even though it sounds like they're not having a happy experience in that loving but not liking each other, there's still something that draws you in and wants to be in that world.
I think it was the idea that, I think this is probably early signs of introversion, this idea that you could be with people, and they also had a very big house, you know, they could go off and be alone at any time they liked, but this idea that you didn't have to get on with people, and that some people just didn't suit you, and you could just remove yourself from the vicinity, and that would be better for all concerned, is quite a nice idea, I think, to be alone in a crowd. So I used to go quite often when I wanted to feel more alone, I'd go to IKEA and wander around there, or work in the cafe, because then you're in a crowd, you are away from more people. It's clearer that you're on your own, it's clearer that you're not interacting with people, and that makes you feel better.
Oh, that's going to be our clip for the episode, when I want to be alone. I go to IKEA. I've not heard of any other writers who go to IKEA to write. I think that's fabulous.
I bet that...
But it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense.
It does, in a twisted, oblique kind of way. I think so. You can't, you know, if you're alone, you're just alone. I mean, I'm alone in the house now. What does that mean? That's easy. I need to go and be around people to really feel that I'm not communicating with anyone.
I did just hear a siren when you said, I don't know if an alarm goes off when you say you're alone, or that sort of, you know, being as alone as we can get in these times.
My husband and child go, oh, she's got free time. What can we ask her? What can we ask her to find?
Are there any writers where you've sort of coveted their routine or had to go at it? I have a slight, an interest and also a resentment in the way we're like, well, you know, Anthony Trollope went and like delivered a round of post before he wrote. I don't know, that wasn't part of his writing routine, but the way we sort of fetishise and remember.
I'm very envious of anyone who basically has a wife, I think, or a wife type entity in their lives, which is, you know, most authors in most of history. You know, you've got Trollope able to sit down and please himself once his work is done. Woodhouse, I expect, was similarly taken care of. But the one that always makes me, I think I may even have mentioned this on the middle, so apologies if I have. But I remember reading years and years ago, before I even became a wife and mother, and still thinking, oh, that's a nice life, was when I read an interview with Martin Amis, who said, well, obviously I get up and I just spend the first 2 hours of the morning reading, just to restock the tanks. I was like, oh my God, what a world that encapsulates. But yes, that's what I'd like. I'd like, 2 hours to read, first of all, and then get on with my writing day, which is not how it works at all.
Oh, as a woman with huge demands on me, a lot of time to be lazy, I do like to start the day reading. But I think that's really interesting as this notion.
I want this for everyone.
This is what we should all have. But this idea of kind of restocking the tank. And I think I hear lots of writers say, well, I can't possibly read a thing when I'm writing. And I try to not read anything that feels too close to what I'm doing, because there's always that fear of, I think I've got this right. When our first ever episode, we had Dolly Alderton, and she was saying that she was sort of going back over, I think, the first draft of Everything I Know About Love, and she'd written a line. She's like, oh, that sounds good. I'm really pleased with that. Like, well done, me. And then had another thought, and I can't remember who the poet was, but she's like, oh, that's John Betjeman. That's not me. I can't use this. I can't keep this in. And so there is always that sort of, can I write or am I just a mimic?
Am I just parroting? Yeah.
But I do think it keeps that bit of your brain in good nick to be in the, in someone else's imagination.
Yeah, I think it basically depends what stage of writing you're at, isn't it? If you're in the middle of a novel, I can see that many people's urge would just be to, watch telly and chill out at the end rather than read and use that same half of your brain. But if you're just noodling around and you're doing research or you're doing your notes or you're just doing outlines, I still read as much as I do any other time. But once you're deep into it, I think it does sort of drain you enough that, I don't know, you sort of need it. You need stimulating in some other way. And just a night's sleep will restock your word tanks enough if you've just got to write your own. Write your own blinking stuff is hard.
It really is. I was wondering, what is on your pile? Is there anything that you have not yet read that you're really, really, really excited about getting to? And also now, with me as your witness, you've said you are going to commence the rereading. What you're going to reread first for comfort?
For comfort reading, I'm going to go back to Nora Lofts. I was foolish not to. And she's so brilliant. And you get, I've only read her once. I could barely remember any of the plots anyway. It would be like reading a new book. So I don't know quite why I've cleaved to this for so long, except that there are just so many books, really good books, I really want to get to. So it's not as if, at least I'm not doing it because I think I should be reading, good books or good literature. It's not that. There's just so many books I've bought and desperate to read and only have a limited amount of time. So at least it's not snobbery that's motivating me. It's just trying to be practical and manage my time. So morally, I think I'm in the clear, but practically, I've been a fool.
Last night, I woke up and I couldn't get back to sleep, and I started rereading American Wife purely because it was on my phone and I could read it in the dark without, causing too many disturbances. I was thinking, it's not that long ago since I read this, and I sort of get to big bits and think, oh, I vaguely remember that this happened and that was, but I was really quite taken aback as to how I remember really, really, really enjoying it and thinking it's wonderful. And also, it's rooted in fact, so things that I should remember. But did I take nothing in? it's like new.
I was so relieved years ago when I read Nick Hornby's, The Great Polysyllabic Spree collection of essays. And he said, I retain so little now. It's like they've slipped completely out of my mind. He said, I just have to hope that there's some deeper shadow memory somewhere that is still going in and affecting me and doing me good, or I'm retaining an impression somewhere in my brain or soul, because otherwise it does feel rather pointless. And I think I just have to hope that's there, because I can't remember. That's why I keep a reading list now, because I can't remember what I've read. If people ask me, I'm sorry, I must consult the document. I know I really, really enjoyed this, and it's nothing to do with how much I loved it or admired it. It's just my calcifying brain.
But then I just try to make myself feel better by thinking it can't be infinite. And when we're younger, we are so porous, and there are fewer things, and we can be so much more passionate about them because there's room, and now it's got to be a little bit one in, one out.
Yeah, but also things are new as well, so they strike you with the force of novelty when you first read about, I remember in one of the Antonia Forrest books, in the end of term, Laurie, one of Nicola's twin, has this moment where she's thinking about letting Nicola maybe play in the netball match because she's hurt her leg, it takes a whole paragraph to unpick what she's thinking. When she says, the first part of her mind, the easy part, thought just, you know, how much fun it would be for Nicola to play and how good of Laurie to let her. The second part thought that, you know, if she did this, that then somehow it would come about that she would somehow, you know, fate would reward her by letting her play the part she wanted in the Christmas play. And then the third part, the underneath part, the bit she really didn't like, thought that that if Nicola was discovered, there would be an almighty row, and she almost certainly would not be doing the part that Laurie covets in the play. And even though Laurie still wouldn't be doing it, she wouldn't mind so much. And so she you know, sort of broke apart, unpacked all these layers. And I remember thinking, oh my God, other people, that means everyone else probably has layers of internal life, just like I do. That's amazing. And I was, you know, sort of looked out onto humanity slightly differently after that. Whereas now I don't really see how anything could strike me with that force in what I read now. So it's, of course, it's not going to sink in the same way. You know, I can still partially at least recite that from memory from 30 years. Oh God, no, much more than 30 years ago, 35 years ago, because it's new and you're open to it. And as you say, you've nothing else crowding it out.
And maybe that's all that matters, really. It doesn't matter if we don't remember the last five things we've read without consulting a list, as long as we remember those special, intense first things still.
Yeah, I hope so. And there, yes. I do wish I could actually just remember what I'd read.
So what's the next new or new to you book that you may not remember immediately afterwards, but that you're looking forward to?
One I will remember, because it's non-fiction and I find those easier to remember, is Word Hoard by Hannah Vedeen, I think. Sorry, again, names. But definitely called Word Hoard. It's about, as I say, non-fiction book about the vestiges of old English that are left in our current English, modern English. And it's just a lovely, lovely read. Again, it's one of those books, like we were talking about in the context of fiction, but one of those books where by someone who's, you know, so, so knowledgeable, so steeped in their knowledge that they don't have any desire to show you how clever they are. They only want to communicate their knowledge and their enthusiasm. And it's written with such love and care and accessibility to the layperson that you can feel it just doing you good as you you know, feeding your soul and your brain at the same time. So I'm loving that. I've just started that, and then I've got 9 billion others lined. I'm reading my first Karen Slaughter, who again which is a thriller, and again just a fantastic storyteller, a bit like Lee Child and Jack Reacher, just pound, 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 hit the beats and get you through it, and just a really good invigorating read. And then after that, what shall I do? I'll probably do The Royal Game by Anne O'Brien, which is historical fiction. And oh God, just so many. I could look around this room and give myself palpitations at all I want to read and all I will read. Cunning Women by Elizabeth Lee, Glove Maker, Anne Weisberger, Mordew by Alex Phoebe. I'm going to try, because it's a bit out of my comfort zone, because it's again a bit fantastical, a bit fantasy, but everyone says it's brilliant and will suit people even if they don't like fantasy.
Oh, I like the sound of that, as someone who, when you mentioned, you know, dragons, yeah, and swords, I had that very sort of visceral no thank you, but no, that I will try. But it sounds very, you know, varied, very much a sort of, you know, bookish five a day. Or
yes, it's not deliberate in any way. I've never been very affected by what you should be reading. I mean, you know, whenever a prize long list or short list comes out, I've never read more than one or two on it that I just happened to come across them because I wanted to read them because I liked them as they came out. And that, in that sense, I'm very badly read, not consistently.
Well, I'm always delighted with myself. I have read one or two sort of already by, you know, by dint of just wanting to read them.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the only way to do anything, isn't it, really? Do it for love, not It's the equivalent of peer pressure now. Mm. People say, oh, have you read blah, blah, blah. And no, I haven't, because I don't fancy it. I'm just like, I'm not going to your nightclub at the age of 14 because I don't like it and it's horrible. It doesn't suit me. Go away. Leave me alone. Let me do my thing.
I think it's the only way to be. Well, thank you so much for brilliant, brilliant book list. And I'm very excited about what I'm now going to go away and read.
Yes, I'm going to go and do an Invitation to the Waltz. I know I have a copy. I'm going to go and do it.
I really, really hope you love it and that I haven't oversold it, because that is always the fear. But it's
I have got a copy because I know I will.
But it's not like I'm the only person in the world. It's like, Rosamund Lemon, she's great.
It's also the equivalent of laying down wine, isn't it? You know, I have bought it. I know it's a book for me. I just haven't got around to it yet. Maybe now's the time.
Thank you so much. It's been so, so lovely to chat. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Huge thanks to Lucy. Are We Having Fun Yet? Is out now, published by Souvenir Press. I love this book. It's wise, wildly funny, rightly infuriating, and if you have yet to read it, I'm very jealous. You can follow us at YBooked on social media, look out for book recommendations, words of wisdom from old guests, and occasional shelfies. We love it when you share the podcast with your friends, and thanks so much to everyone who's left us a 5-star review. It helps other people to discover us and new books. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Lucy at acast.com/booked and check out her selection in our bookshop on bookshop.org. We'll be back next week. For now, I leave you with this from A.L. Kennedy. If ever the difficulties of your life seem overwhelming, consider the prospect of being eaten alive by savage penguins and rejoice that such horrors are unknown to you. See you next time.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.